This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm here today with Dr. Miguel Perez Torres from the Andalusian Institute of Astrophysics, which is based in Granada. Miguel is currently a visiting scientist at JBCA. Hi.
Hi, Indy. Nice to see you.
So, first of all, could you tell us a bit about your research interests and what it is you actually do?
Yeah, sure. I'm mostly interested in supernovae in nearby galaxies in our local universe, and also prolific supernova factories, starburst galaxies that do produce many supernovae per year.
Okay, could you talk us through the basics of supernovae for our listeners?
Sure. So supernovae represent the death of very massive stars that weigh more than 8 to 10 solar masses. And when they do explode, they produce fantastic explosions. Their shocks do interact with the surrounding medium, and it is this interaction that produces lots of radio emission. That's what brought me to JBCA.
Okay. And what are you using to observe these supernovae?
So we use interferometric arrays. In particular, we use the eMERLIN and the European VLBI network. VLBI stands for long baseline interferometry. So basically, it's like using several radio telescopes, which are far away, in a way that practically allows us to see very little fine details of these supernovae. So with eMERLIN, we don't really get to the point of seeing their structure, but we use the very fine sensitivity of the eMERLIN array to detect them up to distances of 100 megalight years.
Wow, okay. So actually, give us a sign of kind of distance scale. Is that very far away for supernovae, or is it close, or in cosmic terms, I suppose?
Okay, yeah, sure. That's actually called the local universe. These are nearby galaxies. So for astronomers, this is really small distances. Actually, the problem is that the farther you go, the less they emit. I mean, the less light comes to us, and it's very hard to detect them to very far distances.
Okay. And so, I mean, are these supernovae of one kind? Because there are many different types of supernovae. So what are the characteristics of these guys that you're looking at?
So we mainly follow the so-called core collapse supernovae. These come from the death of stars that are very massive, as I said, above 8 or 10 solar masses, because their interaction do produce a lot of, the interaction with the circumstellar material do produce a lot of radio emission. However, actually, what brought me here at this time was not just that, also this particular study, but in particular the fact that Type 1a supernovae, which are the other type, they come from, they are called thermonuclear supernovae, because one white dwarf, which is not so massive, white dwarfs do explode when they reach the so-called Chandrasekhar mass of 1.44 solar masses. Very
okay.
So they are much less massive, and they are not expected in principle to produce radio emission. However, there are two scenarios. In one of them, they would produce a relatively small amount of radio emission.
Okay.
Those two scenarios are where either we have two white dwarfs. In that case, no radio emission should be expected, because essentially you don't have material to interact with.
Right.
Okay. Whereas if you have one white dwarf that explodes and during the latest, the last stages of its life has been close to a main sequence star, like the Sun.
Sure.
So this main sequence would have been feeding some hydrogen, some material. Then when the supernova explodes, this interaction would produce some level of radio emission. So far there has been no detection of detection of radio emission from any of
Type 1A
supernovae.
I see. Okay. So these Type 1As are the famous standard candles that you can use to measure distance in the universe. Is that right?
Exactly. Indeed, that's the case. So it is quite kind of funny that we do use these standard candles to make even cosmological achievements, and this has been, as you know, Nobel Prize awarded a couple of years ago. And on the other hand, we still don't know what makes a supernova 1A. we don't know which is the scenario that really produces them. So it's kind of odd that we do use them as if we knew them perfectly well. Mm-hmm. Still, it's not clear.
We know very little about the actual mechanisms that trigger these things.
Right.
I see. And so with the other population, the core collapse radio population, how do you go about finding these things and observing them? Do you have a catalogue of supernovae that you already know of? Are you trying to find new ones? How does it work?
What we do is that we have collaborators that work on the same kind of supernovae and detect them in the optical, very quickly classify them, because they get a spectrum and they know the type.
I see.
If it is the type of core collapse supernova, which is type 1B, C, type 2, well, I won't go into any detail here, they alert us. And then depending on this specific type of core collapse supernova, we start the monitoring or not. So far we are observing those that explode in the nearby 20 megaparsec,
okay.
25 megaparsec, which corresponds to about more or less, a bit less than 100 megalight years.
Okay. How many of you have you got? What's the sort of sample size of supernovae that you've observed so far?
So, well, I have been granted a limited amount of time, of saving time, and I have to make the best use of it. So, in a reasonable size for this year, it's about 10, 8 to 10 okay. targets. So far, we have we have observations for 3 or 4. So, basically, which is corresponds to 5 months of observation. So I do hope that by the end of this call for which we got time with mm-hmm. Emerlin, mm-hmm. we'll have this 10 or 8 supernovae observed.
Okay, and so once you've got your supernovae, what are the science objectives behind it? What are you planning to study about these things?
We would like to study in a more systematic way how they interact with the surrounding medium. Okay. What is the kind of mass loss rate that they show? These supernova are expected to show mass loss rates, that is the rate of mass that they lose per year, mm-hmm. something like between 1,000th or less, something like 1 over 10,000,
yeah.
the mass of the sun per year.
Okay.
So this is a huge amount. That means in 10,000 years, they would lose completely the mass equivalent of our sun.
Yeah. Okay,
so they are really, really
powerful.
Awful, yeah.
Okay.
Powerful, yeah. So this is one of the main things. The other thing is that we would like to have a number of supernovae observed in the radio so we can understand, we can get what we call the radioluminosity function. How these supernovae, for example, knowing our spectra, what is the radio emission that we should expect, and basically feedback to what we already know from the optical.
Okay, so it's sort of building up a global picture of
yes.
the supernova
yes.
in various wavelengths.
That's
right. Do they emit in any other sort of light, or is it just radio and optical?
No, they do also emit in essentially in all bands. So they are very strong X-ray emitters, for example. They do also emit in the infrared a lot,
mm-hmm.
and of course in the optical. Yeah, the advantage of the radio is that it is delayed with respect to the optical.
I see.
And it's it lasts for a longer time.
Okay.
So in the optical, after, let's say, 100 days, supernovae are so weak, so faint, there is no point in following them unless you use a huge telescope.
Right.
Whereas in the radio, we know that because they are initially very strongly absorbed, we can delay the observations for a few weeks or even months. And actually, some of the supernovae I'm observing in these supernova factories, galaxies that do produce many supernovae in the nearby universe, they are very bright even 5 years after the explosion, which allows a very detailed study of this circumstellar interaction. This can be done at any other wavelengths.
I see. And actually, yeah, so coming back to these supernova factories, which you mentioned earlier on, what are they, and could you tell us a bit more about those? Because I'm assuming it's areas where large amounts of supernovas get produced, but I guess the question is why.
Okay, yeah, good question. So we are observing a number with Emerlin, a number of so-called luminous infrared galaxies.
Okay.
So these are galaxies that are very luminous in the infrared,
sure.
Obvious, as its name says.
Yeah.
The idea is that beyond behind this infrared luminosity, this huge infrared luminosity, lies a lot of star forming activity.
Okay.
And particularly mostly in the centers. So these luminous infrared galaxies are merger galaxies. So imagine a couple of galaxies that start to interact. At some point, they start to merge. This merging initiates a very powerful starburst.
Okay.
So this powerful star, when it starts, it starts to produce a lot of infrared emission because the massive stars do emit a lot of ultraviolet emission, not infrared, but it hits the dust that surrounds the massive stars. And it is this dust that radiates at longer wavelengths at the infrared. And when one sees one of these galaxies, which is, it has an infrared radio emission that doesn't really correspond to what you see in a normal galaxy like ours, then you know that there is a very powerful star forming activity there. And therefore, you know there must be a lot of supernovae.
But that seems a little bit counterintuitive, because if supernovae happen at the end of star lifetimes, why would they be going on in a place where stars are being born continuously?
Okay, yeah. So the thing is that the stars, very massive stars, leave very little. A massive star of, let's say, 10 or 20 solar masses, let's take 20 solar masses, just after 4 to 5 million years dies. This is very little in terms of galaxy lifetime. So our galaxy has lived for 5 billion years. That means that in just a fraction of 1,000 of this life, all these supernovae are starting to pop off.
And I see.
So actually this star bursting galaxies, these processes last for just a 40 to 100 million years, which is is of course not just four. This is still a small fraction of the galaxy's lifetime. So at the end of the day, they are telling us a story about very recent starburst activity.
Right. So you basically got stars sort of forming and dying all in one really intense period, and then it kind of calms down after a while.
Yeah.
Okay. And so are you studying these starburst galaxies / supernova factories also with eMerlin, or?
We are studying them with eMerlin.
eMerlin
doesn't have the resolution, the angular resolution to really detect each of these single supernova. Sometimes it does, but in the very central part where most of the activity is happening, we do have to revert to the use of the European VLBA network.
Okay.
So we use then even higher angular resolution instruments in the radio to really detect each of these single supernovae.
And I'm assuming there's also, I guess, infrared observations of these because they mainly emit in the infrared.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing is that the infrared instruments do not have the angular resolution to tell us anything about these particular detailed stories in the center of these galaxies. So they are very useful. They are very useful. They provide us with very good diagnostics, but certainly they cannot beat the angular resolution provided by radio observations using interferometric arrays.
So the very long baseline arrays are sort of the microscopes that you use to get out the little tiny details in the middle of the galaxies.
Yeah, you said it better than I did. Yes, in fact, these are like the microscopes we use to really see each of these bacteria exploding around.
In the middle of the galaxy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. Actually, yeah, because, I mean, I guess if you couldn't really study this with visible wavelengths because the dust would just block everything out, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So optical is not feasible to start with because essentially all the light has been absorbed. Even if it wasn't absorbed, like, for example, the infrared, the angular resolution is not enough.
Okay, and so again, like, what are the underlying objectives of studying starburst galaxies? And
two main. One of them would be to search for individual supernovae and test independently of scenarios what is the star formation rate by actually tracing the death of these massive stars. And the second is that nowadays there is a lot of astronomers trying to understand the star forming galaxies at high redshift, that is early in the universe.
Okay.
And basically, they are assuming that there is a very well-known, quotation marks, very well known, radio infrared correlation. So basically, they use as, you know, they believe that when you have a measurement in the infrared or in the radio, you can transform this into an infrared value, and this from here, from this calibration, to know roughly the star formation.
Okay.
So this is actually not so well known, and our intention is actually to study in detail a representative sample of galaxies in the local universe in the radio, compared with the infrared observations, and either calibrate very well, very precisely this, or understand the possible biases in this. Because when we will extrapolate, all this is actually being done, and sometimes with not so much care, when we do extrapolate this to back in the early universe, any mistake here, when you can imagine, you extrapolate back to 13 billion years, you definitely make up with very wrong numbers.
I see. So studying the galaxies around us is going to help us understand sort of stuff that's a lot further away.
Yeah.
And on a final note, speaking of supernovae, there was one that was observed very recently that just appeared. So are you looking at that one at all?
Yeah. Actually, you know that it was discovered by a student and his teacher I think from London.
Yeah, UCL, I think. Yeah.
So yeah, quite impressive.
Yeah.
So London has such a good sky after all. Yeah. jokes apart. I tried to get time, and I did succeed in getting time both with the Merlin array and the Evian array. And one of the reasons to come here was actually come here to reduce this data. And for reasons that are of confidentiality, I will not tell you the results, but you will follow the GVCA astronomers, Rob Beswick and Megan Argo and Tom Maslow, who are my collaborators here. And, and maybe sooner or later you will see a press release.
Brilliant. Exciting stuff. All right. Thanks a lot, Miguel.
Thanks a lot, indeed.
Thank you.